Welcome to Neurosalience, the OHBM podcast.
Welcome to the Organization for Human Brain Mapping Neurosalience podcast. I'm Peter Banatini, and here I discuss all things brain imaging with scientists from around the world. Today, it's my great pleasure and deep honor to talk with Dr. Marcel Meslem, who's a giant in the field of neurology and one of the founders of OHBM. Dr. Meslem is Chief of Behavioral Neurology and the Ruth Dunbar Davy Professor of Neuroscience at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine and Professor of Behavioral Neurology at the Weinberg College of Arts and Sciences. Dr. Meslem received his MD from Harvard Medical School in 1972, and in 1976 completed residencies at Boston City Hospital and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, also in Boston. After a one-year postdoc at Harvard University, he began his tenure in Chicago at Northwestern. Dr. Meslem's work has been both prodigious and impactful over the years, as his almost 1,000 papers have been cited over 140,000 times. He's written the seminal book, Principles of Behavioral and Cognitive Neurology, and has produced many landmark papers, a few of which we'll discuss on this podcast. One paper that I wanted to mention right here is what I consider a masterpiece. Published in Brain in 1998, entitled From Sensation to Cognition. I think this should be required reading of everyone in the field of brain mapping, as it lays out so concisely and eloquently a breathtaking perspective of the structure and functional organization of the human brain. The writing is just amazing. Dr. Meslem's research is extremely broad and diverse, having impacted such areas as neural networks and functional imaging, dementia, Alzheimer's disease, primary progressive aphasia, cholinergic pathways, acetylcholinesterase studies, cognitive psychology, neurology, and neuropsychology. He's also developed early in his career a neuronal marker, tetramethylbenzidine, that profoundly impacted research in this area. In this inspiring conversation, we discuss his early career and what was important for his success. We delve into research culture and the value of opportunistic research, the value of having the freedom and resources to try many things and rapidly change directions that follow interesting leads. We also discuss some of the exciting early days of neuroimaging and OHBM. Lastly, we go into some of his current research on primary progressive aphasia and the study of temporal pole disease as a window to the temporal pole functional significance. It was truly a pleasure to talk with Marcel. He's brimming with wisdom, as well as quite a bit of hard-won experience and knowledge. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Marcel, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. I am really excited about this interview. It also gives me an opportunity to see you.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't seen you in a while. Hopefully, I'll see you in person at one of these meetings sometime soon. But so why don't we start at the beginning with your just a little bit of how you started, what was involved, the serendipity, what major events maybe made inroads in terms of your deciding what to do. And so you started in the early 70s and you've been very active ever since. So I'm curious.
It does seem like a long time, which it is. Well, I think probably the most reasonable starting point would be when I was in college. And like every college student, I considered just about every major, from astronomy to philosophy, anthropology, economics. And then I took a course on psychoanalysis, on Freud. And I was mesmerized. And I pretty much decided that's what I was going to do. But as I was pondering on that, it you know, Freud himself was a neuroanatomist. He started, I think his first paper was something really on the testicle of some worm of some kind. He was pretty basic. And then he went into this, his discovery through probably his interaction with Charcot at the Salpêtrière. And, but then he came to a point in his career where he wrote a paper, I think it was called Project on Neuroanatomy or something, where he basically confessed that he had no hope that all of this was going to be linked to some neurology at some point or another. That was a little bothersome. And at that time, you know, it's hard to believe, but the relationship of mind to body was still very murky. I mean, just showing that was sort of an achievement. So I took a course in psychophysiology. So, you know, this was basically a glorified lie detector. So we would hook up people to heart rate, pupillary size, respiration rate, galvanic skin response, and make them do different things. I mean, one fascinating finding was that every time you were doing digit span, that you had a deceleration of the heart, beat by beat. And then, you know, whenever you had some excitement, galvanic skin response was going up. And I was given the opportunity to run wild in the laboratory. So I could go, you know, it was the William James building at Harvard, and I had the keys. I would go in on weekends. I actually hooked up one of my girlfriends and I asked her to think about the most exciting thing she could think of. And the polygraph went off the scale. I never know what she was thinking about. But, you know, those were the findings to say that really the mind and the body somehow are connected. And I wrote my thesis on something similar, well, related. My advisor was Charlie Gross, who probably you know well. He was then at Harvard. Yeah. And I wrote my thesis in schizophrenia. I went to a state hospital and measured eye movements with a very primitive method while I was giving a choice between two shapes to look at. One was symmetrical, the other had a little asymmetry. It was unusual. And I found in the chronic schizophrenics, now in the paranoid schizophrenics, they were like normals. They always looked more at the unusual shape. Because it was novel.
Yeah.
And in the chronic schizophrenics, there was a significant avoidance of the novel. So in a way, it was a behavioral measure of their withdrawal. So this was my undergraduate thesis. And obviously by that time, it was clear which direction I was going to take. In medical school, I ran into the man who has had the most influence on my career was Norman Geschwind. He had just published his disconnection syndromes paper. And I did my clerkship in medical school in his department. And believe it or not, the first case I was asked to examine as a medical student had an occlusion of the left posterior cerebral artery. So that gave him the classic syndrome of pure alexia without a graphy. So here is a person who can write beautifully, but can't read what they wrote.
Oh, wow.
And also because the artery supplied the hippocampus, the person also had an amnestic syndrome like HM. Hmm. Well, you know, once you see a patient like that and you have the anatomy, and suddenly you figure out that You know, there's more than heart rate and galvanic skin response. There's really something rationally wired in the brain that can explain very complex issues.
Yeah.
So that was pretty much the decision-making process. The idea was to let everybody a great deal of freedom. We were on the 9th floor of the Boston City Hospital. Every patient that was discussed by Geshwind, and occasionally as a visiting professor, we had Jerry Letvin, who wrote this incredible paper on what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain. I mean, it was way ahead of its time in single unit recordings in a behaving animal. That atmosphere created the situation where every single patient, in addition to being a patient that we cared for, was an experiment of nature that allowed us to ask questions about how the brain worked. And then, you know, one flight of stairs up was Deepak Pandya and Gary Van Heusen. I could just go into the lab and really just fool around.
Wow.
No one asked questions. I could, you know, I mixed solutions. I made all kinds of variations. My fingers were always tainted with silver nitrate solutions. I got asthma. I had to go to emergency room because, you know, we didn't wear masks when we perfused animals with formaldehyde. That was the excitement that led to my, I think, still existent passion for this, exploring how complex behavior is mapped on brain substance. You know, I know this is too long an answer to your question, but
that's perfect.
That's what comes to mind.
Yeah, no, this is perfect. And there's a lot in there that you mentioned that's really important. I think there's something to say for, well, one, obviously at their early times and even still now, it's like, you know, there's these interesting puzzles that you have just enough information to try to sort of delve in and get a little bit more information about the connection between, you know, the brain and the mind. And also there's something to say, and I think that's really maybe lacking today, is just this really enriching environment, like you were saying, where you could spontaneously go in and just do stuff and play around and try things. You know, things are a little bit more regulated, a little bit more restricted. Every experiment needs an IRB approval, or which, you know, obviously that's very important, but it's interesting. And I have similar experiences with, you know, early days of fMRI, just trying things. It would be nice to try to figure out that balance in a way that, you know, obviously is safe and useful, but allow more of that sort of spontaneous playing. I think you would foster more scientists like yourself. So, yeah, that's great. So, that's a great background. And how would you say then? So you sort of described in some sense that your particular environments. What was the general culture like? I mean, was it as far as specialties? Was there more siloing of disciplines? Were there sort of paths that were being pursued that were potentially dead ends? Or, you know, it's like what was the time like in terms of the scientific culture?
Well, you know, I've reflected on that, and I think every generation thinks it is very special. But I must say that something magic happened in the, I would say, late 70s and through the 80s. It was just, I mean, it was like being in a toy store. One of them was this unbelievable research on single unit recordings in the monkey, in the behaving monkey. I mean, Vernon Mountcastle, Hivarinen and Poranen in Finland, Sato and Sakata Ito in Japan. I mean, suddenly, I will never forget one experiment that really floored me. In the monkey, this was a go-no-go experiment. So first, they teach the monkey that color is the important thing. No, sorry, shape. So a circle was a go, and a cross was a no-go. So the animal, they record from a unit that can make the distinction. And while the circle is go, you know, gives a nice, robust response. So then they change the contingency. Now color is the important variable. So green becomes no go. And suddenly this single neuron that gave a big response to a green circle gives no response to a green circle. So how do you understand that circuitry? And this was the kind of insight that then, in a way, made connectivity studies in the monkey brain absolutely essential.
Yes.
And there were people, I think, just about everybody, many of whom you know in the general, who later came to the OHBM culture, you know, they earned their wings doing a connectivity study in the monkey. And there, it was unbelievable because already Hubel and Wiesel had created this notion of simple, complex, hyper-complex. There was a hierarchy.
Yes.
But that was in primary areas. And now, as we work on the monkey, we find the hierarchy was in the association cortex as well.
Yeah,
I think that created developments on how to understand these distributed networks that were overlapping and yet had an individuality of themselves. And then, you know, the third component was the revival of behavioral neurology in the United States, primarily because of Geschwind's influence. Mm-hmm. So suddenly, the neurology, the clinical part, started to contribute patients that fit some of these things. There were people with akinetopsia. There were people with alexia. There were people with, behavioral syndromes, selective amnesias. And then, of course, the other huge ingredient is functional imaging, which initially started with PET. But, you know, PET was a rich man's club.
Yeah.
Very few places could afford a cyclotron, a PET, and so on. And then fMRI came up. It was the common man's, you know, tool. Right. And, you were very much part of the creation of that. You know, I read many years ago your summary on the 20-year history of fMRI. And those were the ingredients. And, you couldn't help but be very excited about the field.
Oh, yeah. 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 I mean, there's always this excitement that comes from, right, not only a new method for making a better sort of measurement, but also, new sort of model or construct that sort of opens up questions. And definitely. So as far as I was, just had the question. So when that monkey, I missed, where was that neuron when they were?
Orbital frontal cortex.
In the orbital frontal. Yep. Okay.
And of course, that led to the Tremblay and Schultz findings, which were equally exciting, where they found a monkey who loved apples, but not raisins. And also didn't like something even less. I think it was just pieces of dry corn or something. So Let me see if I can reconstruct that. The neuron in the orbital frontal cortex was very excited about the apple, not with the others. But then they took the apple away. And that neuron gave a much more vigorous response to the raisin, who initially didn't get that. So again, the computational architecture is that somehow that neuron is sensitive to real-time changes in motivational value. I mean, I think these are the kinds of things that just make you wonder what are we dealing with?
Yeah, exactly. And we're still, I think, barely scratching the surface of really understanding that. I mean, it seems that, you know, you mentioned, right, there's this hierarchical but distributed sort of network that has parts, yet they're overlapping. And, you know, it's really hard to put it all together in terms of, you know, behavior still. And so we still, I think, have a long way to go. But I mean, this is, you're right. You're looking at the very beginnings where people had really these deep insights into these measurements that motivated this.
That's why I have a big laugh when there is all this excitement about artificial intelligence. I mean, the people working there have no idea about what real natural intelligence is about.
Yeah. I completely agree. And yeah, trying to have a simple model of what's going on and applying that to the brain, that's a place to start maybe, but yeah, I think we'll find it's much more, you know, probably much more complex, yet what much more elegant than we have any idea of yet. So you know, you keep on, so even from the start though, so many people just go into medical school and they become practicing clinicians. You practice, but also, I mean, you've always been doing research. How difficult was to establish that sort of research part of what you have been doing?
You know, I really have to give a tremendous amount of credit to Geschwind, Van Heusen, Pandya. They were so welcoming and so generous. And it was an atmosphere that was so saturated with hypotheses, speculations, incredible competitiveness. I mean, every time, every week or month, when we got the latest issue of Journal of Comparative Neurology, we were scared, we were scooped about some connection or another. It was really swashbuckling. It was like the Wild West. And the beauty was, and again, no offense to functional imaging, but you know, what's the percentage of functional imaging discoveries that get confirmed by other experiments? In anatomy, once you find a pathway, it's eternal. There is nothing that is going to change. I mean, the excitement of that kind of, when we found out all the, you know, arrangements of auditory cortex, of how the hierarchies work, the amygdaloid connections, hippocampal fields, it was indescribable. It was once that happened, it was impossible to just go and become a clinician, especially in neurology, where we usually give very bad news to patients. And the only way to prevent deep depression was to have research that was a sort of an upper. So I've continued that, but you know, I've been lucky that the finances were not an issue. Now, I've been continuously NIH funded, believe it or not, since 76. So wow. I did get a lot of funding, but that would not have been enough. I mean, I couldn't have built a laboratory if Pandya and Van Heusen didn't open the doors for me.
Yeah.
I've just been fortunate.
Yeah. That's, And that's great. That's incredible. So as far as, and so you have your lab and then, and you have your practice and it's, and this is, it's interesting when I talk to young, people who are trying to pursue like MD PhDs or whatever, they sometimes are just ambitious and they just want both. And it's like, really it's for doing clinical research and, you know, and you have a setup, you've always had a setup that is extremely complementary as far as that's concerned. And it's, you know, the ideas from one translate to the other. It's almost, jumping ahead maybe a little bit, but not, we can jump back. And that's the idea of translation. Of certainly you do this in your research in terms of your ideas, but how difficult is it? I mean, I know that maybe at a individual patient level, you can translate your understanding to the patient to some degree, but how hard is it to get your findings? How hard is it for them to, or the techniques to make traction clinically?
You mean to become useful?
Well, not to become useful, but even like, FDA approval and there's different levels of this.
I did dabble once with cholinergic treatments and I got IND and it didn't go. I'm not made for clinical trials and developing. I guess I don't like to be rich. The translation is really more. Let me put it this way: that look at the difference between NSF and NIH. That NIH has a mandate from Congress to heal people. And then when you write your grant proposal, you fill it up with this so-called translational part and so on. And most of it, I must say, is either naive or just overreach.
Yeah.
But then look at astronomy. I mean, you throw out the Webb telescope and all sorts of things. And I'm sure the translational part says, we're going to get meteorites and find rare earth metals and something. But really, deep down, we want to understand the universe. Yep. How did it start? What did it? I have to confess that my approach has been to be curious about how we can understand brain function. Now, many of my patients have appreciated the insight they get into their disease and so on. Yeah. But I wish I could say that I have a new drug that I've developed, a new pill. I haven't, though in my cholinergic work, I have indirectly contributed to the cholinesterase inhibitors. Yeah. But again, the main goal in that work was pretty much the neuroscience of cholinergic projections.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love your analogy with astronomy. That's perfect as far as, there's no way, I mean, with astronomy, practical applications are we might eventually travel to other planets or whatever, but. And I completely agree that, what you write in NIH grants as far as the translation versus what probably is the real impact of all of this, the pure curiosity and the deep understanding of the brain is much more nuanced and more significant in the long run than any sort of, immediate timeline. So there's a value to that. And I think it should be brought out more. I completely agree with that. That it just is, and in itself, understanding the brain. So let's just shift gears a little bit and maybe talk a little bit about OHBM. So you and I have both been part of that since the very beginning. This podcast goes to most people who are in the OHBM community and sort of associated with it. So what was your, I could spend podcasts on talking about OHBM and its history, but I'm curious from your perspective of, you know, what was it like starting out, and what was it like, you know, having this first meeting? And, you know, what was
people again, let me put a little background that when we were dealing with all these issues, not issues, opportunities, single unit recording, so on and so forth, something came up. I think it was Denmark, Ingvar, who was doing carotid injections and finding out that during, I think it was a Digispan task, that there was more blood in the front lobe. Now, initially, I didn't believe it. I mean, if I were to design a brain, why would I create a situation where I needed more blood when I was doing, you know, function? I mean, it seemed wasteful. And then too much control. Where is the controller that puts the blood there? And then, of course, PET scan came in, SPECT scan and PET scan. And those were very exciting. And, you know, especially in the Hammersmith group. But then, you know, you needed cyclotron, as I said, and so on. Didn't work. But nonetheless, you know, the seeds of imaging were there. And then for me, when did Jack Balliver publish his science paper? Was it 91 on?
Yeah, that was 91.
91, yeah.
Yeah.
So I was still in Boston then. I got a call from Jack who said, you know, you won't believe this. You have to come down to Charlestown. We have this MRI that when we do a checkerboard stimulus that you see something in the occipital cortex. Now, I think he only had use of the magnet on Saturdays. So now in those days, my wife and I had a house in Provincetown on the Cape, and we religiously went there Friday evening and came back Sunday. But I made an exception that day. I told her, I said, look, this is looks great. So I go down to Charlestown, and Jack and his team are there. And that's the one day where it didn't work. There was something wrong with the magnet or so on. So I sort of left with mixed feelings about this method. Well, of course, then it just simply exploded. And then there was this meeting in the San Raffaele Hospital in Milan in 1992, where, you know, I still have a picture of that. Very hard to recognize all the people that were over 100 people. But, you know, Brenda Milner was there, Mort Mishkin was there, a very, very young Carl Friston, you know, Richard Pocoyek, so on. These are some of the people I recognize there. And that was, you know, one of the people I had a chance to talk to was Justine Sargent, who at that time was writing these beautiful papers about face recognition and so on with PET. And then, you know, with MRI and so on, of course, Bernard Mazoyer had this idea to put a Paris meeting together. In a godforsaken suburb of Paris that I remember a long metro trip. But what a meeting. What a meeting. It's, you know, and at that time, I only salivated at people who did functional imaging. I had no ability to do that. And so I wanted to be critical. I think I gave the analogy in my talk of functional imaging to a rose that has beautiful petals, but also a lot of thorns, and that it was important to understand how far we were from the anatomy and physiology we've found out in the monkey to be able to get to that level. And then I had the opportunity to do some functional imaging. I worked on spatial attention And that's where some of my network ideas came through. And so I became part of the community of OHBM. And then, you know, we had this exciting Boston meeting. Yep. That was the fight, yeah, whether we should call it a society for human brain mapping or organization for human brain. I mean, there were strong feelings. then the decision was made. And then we went through a period where there wasn't council yet. There were some committees that then elections, then council. And then I remember the Brighton meeting where I introduced LNL to the council and said, we really need an administrative office. And we had the great luck to have Laurie Anderson as the first administrator. And, you know, sometimes people look at societies and give credit to the luminaries who are president and head. Laurie, I think, deserves credit for putting OHBM on the map.
Yeah.
And it's with her that we were able to go on and have one great meeting after another, including the one I hosted in Chicago, and especially the one that I remember, who I really was the key to my deciding to write Sensation to Cognition, was the Copenhagen meeting. And the, one of the reasons maybe was it was such lousy weather that I had to be inside and look at every single abstract. And it was exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, I mean, they were really exciting times, not only because the method was new, but the community was coming together. And yeah, I remember distinctly that room actually in Brighton where, you know, I was in the room. I think I was on the education committee or something, and or maybe secretary, and Laurie Anderson. There were two groups. There was one group that wanted to organize it that was not quite that good. But then there was Laurie's group. And yeah, and it was wonderful. We just sort of decided on her, and little did we know how significant that would be. And oh, it was just amazing. As far as, because you really do need that infrastructure to grow in that way. Yeah, and you were chair for, you know, from 2000 to 2002, or, you know, you had the chair cycle where you pre-chair, chair, and post-chair. And, you know, spanning from San Antonio to Brighton to Sendai. And But yeah, every single meeting sort of, and it was interesting too. And I think what was interesting there, I mean, like you were saying, you were already sort of an established scientist. And so what was interesting about those early meetings, as I think about it, is that you already had very mature people in the field all coming together. And I think that made for a really... it's hard to explain the atmosphere, but it was more like they kind of from a top down sort of knew what to do, and sort of, you know, it was exciting because these disciplines were coming together and these people, these actual established disciplines were merging. So as
well
now, but anyway, so that's and then you've been part of it ever since, and I remember the Chicago meeting, which was great as well. So hopefully you'll come back to Chicago one of these days.
Yeah, I remember Laurie organized it. So for the dinner, we actually had a boat moor at the side of the hotel, and we would get out of the hotel and go into the boats for Lake Michigan sailing. And then in Sendai, I don't know if you remember, I was... the chair then, and I went up to give my opening lecture, and there was this robot. Do you remember the robot?
Yeah, came? Optimo. And I remember actually back then it was a big deal that there was that. I mean, there's this robot. I mean, it's a little bit, it's still a big deal, but there it was like way ahead of its time. And I remember I actually had to do something too. I think I was part of some other committee, and they just said, don't touch the robot. Just It's like, whatever you do, you can just let it talk. Don't touch it. So, yeah, it was a really special time. I mean, that's actually what I remember all of that. It was very exciting. And you felt you were really, there was something really exciting happening. And it was nice about the meeting itself is that it was less about, you know, certainly it was about the brain, but it was more about all these methods to bring together to think about the brain, which was in itself exciting. So let's just maybe talk a little bit about, I hesitate because there's so, it's like jumping into an ocean, sort of talking about your research. It's hard to know whether to go into depth into one thing or to keep it broad, but I mean, you've studied everything from, you know, the basic neuroscience to, you know, clinical manifestations of, you know, dementia, as you mentioned, cholinergic pathways. Huge area, and I think maybe worth talking about a little bit, is primary progressive aphasia, Alzheimer's, of course, with your center, and then general cognitive psychology, cholinesterase studies, and also you wrote pretty much the book, Principles of Behavioral and Cognitive Neurology. So I don't even know how to begin, other than asking, you have this broad spectrum. And, you know, what is your style of, you know, it seems like you're very curious and you're very nimble in finding interesting areas and jumping in, but at the same time, keeping this general program running. So how has that maybe evolved over the years as far as that's concerned?
I've really always been opportunistic. I am not devoted to any single method. I just try to do my best to jump into opportunities. Suddenly, a very special patient that opens a new insight, a kind of disease that I become an expert in, and people come to me from around the country. I can do research. Or some imaging method that one of my colleagues develops, and we get some new ways to approach questions. In our center, every participant agrees to brain donation after death. So we have an extensive neuropathology collection. Since I have had the center for 29 years, and patients, even though we like to have them live forever, they do die. And we have a unique collection of postmortem material on different diseases, different syndromes. So we have a team that works on that kind of correlations at a deep level. I don't have to do anything. I sit in my office. It's open door policy. I still have a microscope. What you're looking to see, if you see in the background, the boxes contain about 20,000 slides of autopsy material, each with a clinical history, with longitudinal follow-up, longitudinal imaging. And I have a bunch of very smart, some junior, some not so junior people. And they seem to think I have something to contribute. So they bring me results. And we think about them, we interpret them, and we put them in context. And sometimes there are some areas of research which I consider my own, and then I lead that. But they interact with everything else. You know, this center, which is not in any department, reports to the dean of the medical school, is entirely multidisciplinary. So in one floor, I have people from neurology, psychiatry, preventive medicine, radiology, pathology, cell and molecular biology, neuroscience, they are all together. And then the brain bank, where there are floating brains, is right next to the cognitive lab where we do ERPs.
Yeah.
So this kind of, I mean, you wouldn't believe it. We have neuropsychologists, you know, neuropsychology students who had neuropsychology training, which is great, but doesn't include much basic science, who decided to go into neuropathology. We know we have, which is just, wow. I think, because I tried to create the bubble that Geshwin created for me.
Yeah.
That I could let people, because I have some discretionary funds that I can use to give people some freedom to try things that is new to them. So that's my environment.
That's amazing. And that's actually really, I mean, it's rare. It is hard to build. You have to be a little bit, you know, fortunate, but also at the same time, very, very skilled at certain things in terms of growing these. You know, I almost think it's almost like, I mean, it reminds me of the models of like at Max Planck Institute, you have sort of a principal and then you have their groups, but it's not quite as interdisciplinary as even your group. And I think there should be some, that should be studied because I think that there are incubators of good research and there's a principle by how they should be organized potentially.
But Peter, there are always thorns to the rose. So I have had to pay a huge price because departments are very jealous of what's happening here. And they say, well, we need the credit and the money and so on. So, you know, I have had to do a lot of politics and a lot of constraints because as a center, I cannot give primary appointments. So I have to negotiate with departments to and so on. So I could have grown a lot more and I haven't, but then the pleasure and the science have been very interesting. But I kind of just realized that I haven't answered your question about primary progressive aphasia. You know, it's a disease that I sort of defined again by serendipity in the 80s. I had one patient after another, I mean, not after another, but it just came a bunch of patients over months, maybe a couple of years, who had a progressive language loss. So at that time, there was a dichotomy. If you had an aphasia, you had a stroke. If you had a progressive disease, it has to be memory and Alzheimer's disease. And these were neither. Yep. In fact, what was funny, we had CAT scans in those days, not MRI. And so they would go to a neurologist, and the neurologist would say, well, you have a stroke, but we can't see it. So, you know, it turned out to be this degenerative disease. And over the years, I've been mesmerized by that disease because it just almost made for me. It was a network disease.
Yeah.
And it hit different parts of the hierarchy, and we could dissect it into different components. Then we found out that in addition to classifying it clinically, every type of PPA could be caused by several different neuropathological types, the common denominator being the anatomy.
Yeah.
So we had a three-layered cake. We had clinic, anatomy, pathology, and then there was this asymmetry. I mean, there were patients who, for 10 years, had only the left hemisphere showing degeneration. Wow. So here's a disease that knows to turn left and stays there. So what happened over the years, you know, people say, why in the world would you become a specialist in PPA about so rare that it's not even worth mentioning? Nobody, you know. But what we've done over the years, and I hope this is appreciated, that we made PPA a paradigm for studying anatomy, brain, pathology, anatomy, relationships. That's why I think it is important out of proportion to the rarity and frequency of the disease.
And do you think there are clues in PPA as to how Alzheimer's progresses in general? Or, I mean, I'm also wondering if there's other net, I mean, is there the equivalent of PPA in, you know, visual cortex, or is there other networks that are selectively hit and in this way?
Well, there are. You mentioned visual cortex. There is a certain form of Jakob Creutzfeldt disease, it's mad cow disease. It's called the Heidenhain form, and it hits preferentially visual cortex. Then there is a subtype of Alzheimer's disease caused posterior cortical atrophy. That's its clinical name. And believe it or not, the tangles, which are usually focused in the hippocampus here, they become focused in occipital cortex, including the superior colliculus. And then there's an aphasic form of these diseases, and then, of course, a behavioral form, an amnestic form. So now, is it the case where it hits only one network? No, I don't think we can simplify that way. It's just that we like to classify disease by the initial conditions. So if initially the disease hits a certain network, things are very clear. But if you wait long enough, this is a spreading disease. And then the criticism is, well, you know, it's a diffuse condition. Don't make it look like it's initial. But, you know, that depends on your concept of specificity. And again, I want to mention using this as a paradigm.
Yeah.
Because the experiment of nature is the initial condition, not the terminal condition.
So, as far as the mechanism, I mean, is it how does the pathology transfer? I mean, you can imagine it transferring from neuron to neuron, and then it's sort of along this sort of network pathway. Is it by neural activity, or is it by other sort of anatomic connections?
We have speculations.
Okay.
First, left versus right, or language cortex. One finding is that the PPA patients and their first degree relatives have a higher incidence of dyslexia than others. So we have this speculation that there is a developmental or genetic vulnerability of the language cortex that in some people causes a developmental problem. In others, it's compensated by plasticity, but makes that area vulnerable to an independent neurodegenerative disease. So this is the approach of locus of least resistance.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't explain all the cases, but certain families follow that. Now then, there are other observations that are almost, I don't know what to say, almost incredible. This is now my current research. It's a condition called FTLD TDP type C.
Okay. Nice, simple.
So this is frontotemporal lobar degeneration with abnormality of the transactive response DNA binding protein 43 of type C.
Okay.
Now, it's an abnormality of a normal protein known as TDP43, which deposits as toxic inclusions. And believe it or not, this type C hits preferentially the temporal pole.
Huh.
Now, it could be unilateral left, unilateral right, or sometimes bilateral.
Okay.
So suddenly, the temporal pole that was really terra incognita, because, you know, first, there was a lot of susceptibility in MRI. Secondly, I mean, yes, you could correct for some, but nonetheless, noisy.
Yeah.
Then it wasn't vulnerable to stroke because it had triple vascular supply. And then you couldn't examine the patient if there was a wound there because the person would die. It's too, you know.
Yes.
So nothing was known about this area, almost nothing. And with TDPC, you know, we got into these findings. You know, there are these patients who come in, and if you had a conversation with them in a cocktail party, I mean, you wouldn't know that there's anything wrong. But then look at them and say, now, you wouldn't do that. It was wouldn't be polite. But if you happen to say, you know, look at them and say, what is a pumpkin? And, you know, they'll look at you and say, pumpkin. Is that a game? And they lose the ability to comprehend single words.
Well, that's interesting. That's interesting.
Now, if it's on the right side and then there is some bilaterality, they lose the ability to recognize objects and faces, but they understand the meaning of the world, of the word. And if it's bilateral, it's a combination of all. And yet these people, I mean, I had a patient who was still running a bed and breakfast. I have others who, I mean, think of it this way. If you go to a country where you don't understand the language and, you know, you can still function.
Yeah.
The other thing these people show is a phenomenon known as taxonomic interference. So you ask them, bring me a banana. They will bring you an orange, but not a spoon. You tell them, bring me a hammer. They are likely to bring scissors, but not a banana. So the word is understood in a generic sense. So I'm having a field day studying these patients. We have a very rare collection, and we're approaching it in a neurocognitive way by serial longitudinal examinations, ERPs, DTIs, and so on. And then we're doing site-specific transcriptomics to see if there is something special about the temporal pole that gets hit. And then we're doing cryo-electron microscopy to see if these deposits have something special affinity for the temporal pole. Hmm. Now, all of this is with international collaborations. Our contribution is to provide tissue, DNA, plasma, and clinical information. Right now, that's my passion. That's, in fact, we gave it a grandiose name of Consortium in C. And that's what keeps me awake sometimes at night, figuring out what in the world can determine such specificity.
That is so interesting. I mean, you're right. As you mentioned, fMRI has a hard time getting into there. But I mean, to the extent that we have, I mean, there's you know, something to say for the potential for, you know, there's a face area, but there's also, I mean, that's not in the temporal poles, but then there's like it, recognizing individual faces, like, you know, one face from another.
Yeah.
There's some hints that it might be there as well. So that's really interesting. And it's amazing how, you know, the pathology, you try to understand that in general, but how it, if you look really carefully and like you are, it provides clues that we might be able to figure out something profound.
And, you know, Peter, also this is where being around for a long time helps, because, you know, it took 25 years to put together this group of very special patients. If PPA is rare, this TDPC is 10 times as rare.
So, wow.
I mean, it's a form of PPA, but it's a rare form of PPA.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. That's really, really exciting. I mean, it's exciting and so just to generally switch gears a little bit before we talk, I mean, I know we're running maybe potentially shorter time, but I'll try to keep you a little bit longer here. This is such a great conversation. For the sort of the general, I mean, obviously this podcast is for maybe all the young listeners, but I think a lot of us, you know, we're aware of so much funding going into Alzheimer's disease research. And I always hear about, you know, sort of deeper understanding of, you know, what are the mechanisms and what are the types. But as far as the treatment, I you know, it still seems like, you know, at least that, you know, what's translated to general practice has still been, you know, you're just trying to slow it down a little bit. Do you have any, you know, thoughts on, probably you have many, on the most promising treatments or, you know, what the prospects are or things like that? Or how does understanding translate to treatment?
Yeah, I wish I could say I do. And I should also preface by saying that I hold a minority view on Alzheimer's disease. I am not impressed by amyloid. So I wrote a paper once. I was a review in Neuron about a theory of plasticity. I look at Alzheimer's disease, especially its relationship to aging, as a plasticity failure. A number of conditions that converge to increase the metabolic price that we have to pay for housekeeping activities such as synaptic turnover. And it's like mortgaging your house or failing to paint it. And so we call it degeneration, but actually it's a lack of upkeep over time. And I think the tangles and the amyloid are messengers that bring bad news. And it doesn't help you to kill the messenger. So now the problem with my theory is that, you know, it's unprovable and you can not disprove it either. So it's rightly criticized. I accept all the criticism, but, you know, that's my hypothesis. So I am a little bit skeptical about, and I can give you about 20 different reasons why the amyloid theory doesn't hold. Do I have another? I don't, but I think that possible, we have to protect synapses. So one player that is involved are the microglia. The microglia eat synapses. And there is a lot of they help in most people because they help the turnover. And they eat up, you know, dysfunctional synapses. But when they do it too much, then that's not good. So I think that's one angle that I feel is promising. So going for the inflammatory aspect of Alzheimer's disease, maybe the issues of oxidative stress. You know, none of this is particularly helpful. Everyone has their own cascade that explains everything based on animal models, none of which are perfect. So I wish I could be, you know, we started this, 3-4 decades ago when the first gene was discovered on Alzheimer's disease, the autosomal dominant form. And everyone said that was it. And I must say that genetic discovery hasn't answered all the questions.
Interesting. And right, obviously with the hope that, you know, once you know the causal mechanism, then you can start to get at the prevention and the treatment. But so, I mean, this is really interesting as far as the you're saying that the amyloid might be a signature, but a byproduct and not really something that actually interferes. So what about, it just reminds me, it's a sort of tangential idea that I was just reading a paper on fMRI signal changes with activation and a revamping of the model saying it's not to deliver oxygen to the tissue, but it's to remove waste. And so that's what you need. A pH, you need a constant pH and to removal of byproducts of metabolism. Could it ultimately be a vascular related thing as well?
You know, if by vascular you mean things that much more subtle than a plumbing,
yeah,
it's conceivable. I mean, you know, we've looked at a few things like blood-brain barrier and this and that. There's nothing obvious,
yeah.
But could it be something very subtle like trans-endothelial transport, something at the capillary control, something with the glymphatics that, all of these are, that's why I'm saying that we are at a stage now where no theory can be completely, well, I mean, if you said it's cosmic rays, that would be sort of not likely. But, any theory goes at this point.
Yeah.
We're struggling to find something that's consistent.
Yeah. That's so, I mean, you have so many tools and all the more reason to have multidisciplinary approaches and, to break down the barriers between the departments and to focus on this sort of thing. So I know we're running short of time, but I just wanted to mention, as part of my research, I did, just tried to take a good look at four papers that you had, but I just wanted to focus on maybe one. I mean, you have a couple of, what people would call classics in the literature, not only classics, but ones that they should read. Maybe everyone should take a good look at these. Everything from your tetramethylbenzidine, horseradish peroxidase, that a method of staining that really helped neuroanatomy substantially. That was just, extremely useful. You also had, obviously your classification of primary progressive aphasia paper in neurology in 2011. You had some general papers that were just classics of, Annals of Neurology in 1990, large scale neurocognitive networks and distributed processing for attention, language, and memory. But the paper that actually really struck me, and I don't exactly know why, because it was just a beautiful paper, I thought, was in Brain in 1998. And you probably, it's from sensation to cognition. And I think the reason why it struck me was a beautiful review article of basically the state of the art of what you know in the field about pretty much every aspect of what we care about in the brain. And what the entire field of OHBM cares about, as I was reading it, one, it's timeless in a sense that nothing, there are aspects of it that, obviously have been filled in terms of the details, but nothing is, everything is still there, and I actually have to say that the art of, and this is what I find often in younger scientists and even older scientists, that the art of clear writing is really, I feel, not trained as much. And and when you read your summary of that paper, I really felt like it was as close to poetry as as something I would have read. And I just am curious what your thoughts on how you wrote that paper and how you actually hone your skill of writing, because it truly is a pleasure to read, and because you can actually feel the concepts happening in your head as you're reading it. You're not like trying to understand something. You could actually, it feels like you're just sucked in. It's really, really good.
I'm so I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I felt really excited when I was writing that paper. And there were several. One was the Copenhagen meeting, which really struck me that we were at a point in the field where we could translate the monkey findings into the human. And that was also a time of reflection for me, because I just moved from Harvard to Northwestern, and I was putting together the center. And then I was also getting prepared to write the second edition of my book. So it was a time when I did some reading and, again, single unit recording papers were coming out with great speed. So I did a lot of reading, and it occurred to me that this was time to put together the hierarchical notion, which was really very simple on the surface, about that would combine all cognitive activity around a common structure, a common scaffolding, a common matrix that you could understand things in terms of bottlenecks, in terms of not really, you know, not modular, but interacting networks that had different bottlenecks that we then call the critical areas. And then to figure out that the message is in the medium, not to get sucked in any single method. Now, single unit recording gives a different reality because, good God, you're recording one of 40 billion neurons. So before you make a conclusion, just, you know, wait a little bit. Yes. Now, then functional imaging. Well, you know, let's assume I do behavior A and I have six different areas of activation. Well, you never can tell which is critical, which is corollary.
Yes.
And then you look at stroke. Well, you know, yes, you have a lesion, but good God, the white matter is involved, and who knows where this is going. Then you look at progressive disease, degenerative disease. Well, wait a minute, because in stroke, it's like you pull a plug and the lights are down. In degenerative disease, it's like a short circuit that just spreads through other parts of the brain, as there is plasticity and degeneration. Yeah. So it's important to keep in mind that the methods give you different kind of visions of how the brain is put together. And I had the opportunity in 1998 to, you know, think about these things, and yeah. I put them on paper. Most of it was written on weekends. And, you know, I still feel the excitement as it unraveled, especially when I came to the final section. And I was sort of thinking about the invention of writing.
Yeah, yes.
And I wrote this, I read this little anecdote where it says that writing was invented by a Sumerian king who had his favorite messengers who had a terrible memory. So instead of losing the messenger, the king invented writing so the messenger could bring things without forgetting them.
Yeah. And you had a beautiful description of, right, it's like, you know, we didn't evolve to read and, you know, what sort of process that might be involved in. And also the idea that writing in some sense is the preservation of this collective knowledge that we can then ratchet forward in civilization. I mean, you went all the way into how civilization, how people, you know, will grow with this use of civilization and preserved knowledge, which goes beyond our memories.
It was fun. And I, in fact, I owe it to the editors of Brain to have taken another critical attitude and to have agreed to publish it. And I must say, one of my memorable reactions, a letter that I still conserve, is from Vernon Mountcastle, who wrote me a handwritten letter telling me that he had enjoyed reading the paper.
Oh, wow.
And I really treasure that letter.
That's high praise, and yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, so just to wrap up here, are there any parting words on the future? Any advice for young researchers? You know, just in general. You know, you've given so many bits of insight as we've gone along here, and
First, let me start with an analogy. You know, in the old days, if you wanted to find gold, you just rushed to the West, staked a claim, and started digging. Today, if you want to dig gold, the bureaucracy you have to go through is unbelievable. You know, species preservation, environment, are you infringing on such and such land? And I think that we've gone through that sort of evolution that, you know, in my case, I mean, I was, as I said, protected. And today it's very hard for young people, you know, there's this issue of young investigators that are supposed to be in a different track for NIH funding, but it's a joke because you know, that's young has a different definition at NIH.
Yeah.
And you have to have information and preliminary results, which is really not my definition of letting people start. The K Awards, which actually I think I was partly there in the movement that put them, created them, because mm-hmm. as clinicians we didn't have that opportunity, are very flawed in their structure. So all I would say to young investigators, try to be lucky and find a place where the mentor can create a bubble, protective bubble, at least in part, to create that initial spark that's going to... And then the other thing I must say, and again, I know this is not a popular statement, that, you know, not everybody is fit for research.
Yeah.
And... if you find that your expectations are just not being fulfilled, you know, maybe this is not what you should be doing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's also right. I mean, a lot of people find that out too late or, right, they're you know, they just look at it as a mechanism for their career. But yeah. And I think that, right, what defines that is self-reflection. And what defines pretty much everything you've done is sort of, you know, this insight that comes from, you know, working, but also taking the time to sit back to put things in perspective all the time. So, yeah. And yeah, taking time to do that and is an important thing. And I agree. Yeah. It's hard. I didn't know it. You were associated with the K Awards potentially, but, and I agree.
I don't want to say that I was in any formal way. I have written letters to NIH about the lack of protected time for clinicians. But okay. Whether or not it had any influence, I can't really pretend it did. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, one never knows, but still, either way, having, you know, pushing in that direction. I think, you know, one never knows exactly the mechanisms, but, and I think you're right. I think that there needs, and I love the idea of creating these bubbles. Maybe just using that concept to try to go forward, sort of, you know, making bubbles for your career, bubbles to think, bubbles to play, to you know, explore.
That's why I thought the UK system with the MRC and the welcome grants to a laboratory head rather than to individuals is so wise, because on one hand, it's undemocratic. So in the United States, probably it won't be very popular. On the other hand, it allows the chief to create bubbles.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, I think you're right. And we're still evolving those systems. So, but all right. Well, I mean, we could talk for hours, but I think that this is a good point in which to end this. This has been so fun. And I look forward to seeing you at the meetings in person. And it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Peter. It's, as I said, you know, the art of interviewing is important. And I must say, this was one of the most enjoyable interviews I've had in a long time.
Well, likewise, the same with me. Thank you.
Neurosalience is brought to you by the Organization for Human Brain Mapping. This week's episode was produced by Alfie Wine and Farouk Golban.